The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
To everybody, it's nice to see you all. Nice to practice together. And tonight I wanted to talk a little bit about practice. And there's so many different ways we can consider it and so many different elements that make up practice. But one way that maybe I'll begin with is practice is kind of like a journey. In some ways it's not helpful to think of it that way, but sometimes it's helpful to feel like, okay, it's a transformative path. And to help introduce this idea, I'd like to read a poem. I'd like to start with a poem that outlines or highlights this path. This poem is from thousands of years ago, but somehow it feels, for me, there's a certain timelessness about it. Then we can imagine that it's a similar scenario playing out today. And the poem goes like this. Plowing fields with plows, sowing seeds in the ground, caring for children and family, people gain wealth. Why is it that I, thorough and virtuous conduct, doing the Buddha's instructions, not lazy or proud, have not attained peace? I watched the water, the foot washing water, as it flowed from high ground to low. With this, the mind concentrated like a thoroughbred horse. Taking an oil lamp, I entered my hut. Looking over the bed, I sat down on the bed. Taking a needle, I pulled out the wick. As the flame went out, the mind was freed. This poem describes just some ordinary experiences. The beginning, noticing that other people are getting the results that they want. They are plowing fields, they are sowing seeds, taking care of their family, and they're gaining the rewards from their efforts. Something that's really tangible, you know, you plant a seed, it grows. Some grain, you can take care of your family and bring some to market, sell, and have some prosperity. So the author of this poem said, well, everybody else is getting what they want, but why is it that I I'm not getting what I want? Even though I'm practicing, I'm doing what she's doing what she believes she should be doing, that following the instructions that she was giving, she's working diligently, and still she's not attaining what she had been hoped to attain. And perhaps she's feeling a little bit of frustration or confusion. Why is it that I have not attained release? Maybe there's a certain like striving or straining or something like this. And then when she goes to do the ordinary thing at the end of the day after being barefoot or walking in sandals, just to wash one's feet before going to bed, so that the bed stays clean just an ordinary, humble thing. And watching how the water, the foot washing water, after, in my mind, after washing the feet, just kind of dumping out the bowl of water. And watching how the water flows, in some ways just obeying the laws of gravity, reality. Things always flow downhill, they never flow uphill. Just this way of kind of quieting the mind and having it get, we could use this idea of flowing downhill as being reality, is part of what the Dharma is about too. Kind of like the truth of the way things are is just the way it is. So watching the water flow downhill, kind of getting settling, just being aligned with, okay, it's just this. Time to go to bed. Goes to bed and just turns off the light. Maybe in the same way that we use a light switch nowadays. And something about this shift from going from light to dark, from being able to see to not being able to see, allows the mind to let go. Maybe it was the mind was clinging or identified with or something, whatever it could see, the visual field. But when the visual field all of a sudden went away, then it was the last thing that the mind was holding on to, and the mind was freed. I recently taught a retreat, and one of the co-teachers, he came up with this, he was talking, giving a talk about, you know, the postures. And in the way that he described it, he said, well, you know, the Buddha has talked about these four postures. They're perfectly valid, all four of them. Sitting, standing, lying down, walking. And we sometimes give instructions for all four. We tend to focus on the sitting, but... And then he slipped in this little comment, he said, but I think they forgot there's this fifth posture. It's called in-betweening. Somehow, you know, when you're moving from one posture to the next. And so we might consider that in this poem, getting into bed, leaning over to turn off the light, and just this ordinary movement, but having this shift in the visual field is when something different happened. Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, same story happens with him. It's kind of this in-betweening. After practicing all day, he lays down on the bed. Maybe there's just something about going to bed. It was like, okay. Well, I'm finished with today. With Ananda, before his head hit the pillow, he had this awakening moment. So in-betweening, an opportunity to not, it's something that happens. I myself have had this experience, like been on retreat and a lot of sitting meditation, you know, really some, trying my best with some real diligence while sitting. But then having, like, while standing up to go do walking, having a, kind of like a flash of some of an insight. So it's not so uncommon that kind of like putting in some effort. And then when there's a little bit of a release, when there's some moments of maybe some unguarded moment, but then something new can arise. So this poem, some of you might have recognized it. It's the poem of Padachara. She sits on the altar. She has been here on this altar. It's the awakening poem attributed to her, preeminent nun from the time of the Buddha. And she was a teacher of others. It's a number of people who report how she helped them find their awakening. But one thing that's interesting about Padacharya's bit of her, the backstory, is that she came to practice after experiencing tragedy after heartbreaking tragedy. Her husband dies. First one child dies. The second child dies. Then her parents die. Oh my goodness, right? It's just hard to imagine. So she was kind of like crazed with grief. And she, in this crazed state, she meets the Buddha, who gave her some teachings. And then she decided to practice. And we know from this poem that she practiced with the way that she was in the world. She talked about being virtuous, taking care of others, taking care of herself. Some way that we could talk about virtuous ethics is about having care and respect for others, care and respect for herself. As well as she talked about in this poem not being lazy or proud. So doing what needed to be done, but also not, you know, lauding it over others, or maybe not doing more so that she didn't stand out as being particularly special. Not, you know, striving to be the bestest or mostest in some kind of way. But instead applying the right amount of effort and creating the conditions in which the mind could be settled, could be aligned with just the natural way things go. Water flows downhill. Just tuning into the reality and the simplicity, very uncomplicated. Just watching water flow downhill. So Padacharya's poem, as many of you know, come from this collection called the Terigata. These poems of the nuns from the Buddha's time. Something that I appreciate very much about the Buddhist literature, the suttas, the scriptures, is that we could make this broad generalization, really gross generalization, but maybe it's a little bit helpful sometimes to make these. I like to do this. I like to kind of lump things together into some really broad categories. For me, it's helpful. And one category, I'm sure all of you know, is lists, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and maps. 4 Noble Truths, 7 Factors of Awakening, 5 Hindrances, 3 Characteristics, 10 Paramis, all this, right? And the Buddha kind of saying, there are two things, what two? There's this and that, or, you know, there's so much of this. Myself, I'm fond of these lists. I like them. I kind of like to have things to be ordered and systematized and categorized and all these kinds of things. So we might say that that's one style of the Buddha's teaching, important and valuable. But there's also another style that includes poems, includes things that isn't so systematic and categorized. Poems, stories, similes that evoke something else, that touch maybe a different part of us. Maybe there's a way in which this touches to the richness of our hearts and minds, or that maybe paint pictures that are more evocative. And dare I say, there might be a certain amount of beauty to these stories or similes. I know sometimes I've heard similes and I thought, oh, that's fantastic. It's so evocative. One that comes to mind right now is about the hindrances. And this is sometimes the hindrances in particular described like being there's a number of different ones, but sometimes like the water boiling, you know, there's ill will, and you can't see through the water. When it's water is still, it can be like a mirror, but when there's a lot of ill will, it's boiling and you can't see. And I thought, oh, that's so apt. So it's, you know, communicates something very clearly. So this, there's this, to be sure, there's a beauty also with the structure and the maps and the numbers and all those kinds of things. There's a certain elegance there. But is there a way in which we can tune into what the Buddha is pointing to with some of the stories, some of the poetry, some of the similes? And I know Gil likes to use this word beauty, sometimes to translate this word kalyana, in which talks about the Dharma as beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. So allowing ourselves, when I think of beauty, is something often kind of inspiring. Sometimes going to art museums, which is a different type of beauty, that's the visual and maybe aesthetics, maybe not, which is different than a spiritual beauty, which is this maybe associated with goodness or clarity or some warmth inside of us. But in the same way that sometimes some aesthetic visual beauty and spiritual beauty can really support a sense of inspiration, a way for us to feel like, this is a worthwhile to do, recognizing sometimes it's difficult. Just like in this poem with Padachara, she had tremendous suffering before she came to practice. And then even when she started practicing, right, she's noticing, why is everybody else getting what they want? Well, the farmers, I can see that they're able to reap the rewards of their efforts, and why can't I? These are the words of somebody who is still struggling, having difficulties. So I would like to suggest in practice that we need both. We need both kind of the structured and the guidelines and maybe maps and lists, and holding them lightly, but letting them be a support. But we also need to be inspired and have our hearts feel touched, and maybe there's something inside of us that resonates with some of the stories and poems and similes, these things of beauty. So I'd like to offer another poem, kind of like along those lines. And this poem is attributed to a nun, her name is Citta, which we often translate as heart or mind. And for me, it's a little bit interesting that the poem is attributed to somebody about this, that has this name. It's just two stanzas. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about it after I read the poem. Citta says, though I'm skinny, sick, and very feeble, I climb the mountain leaning on a staff. Having laid down my outer robe and overturned my bowl, propping myself against a rock, I shattered the mass of darkness. So Citta, she talks about her body, even though her mind is about, her name refers to heart and mind, and she talks about her body being sick and this difficulty of walking up a mountain. But I appreciate very much that she's using a staff. She has a cane. She has something to help her. We all need help at different times, different seasons of our practice, and it can take so many different forms. But here's you know, just kind of something that's very obvious, maybe to have that we can see outside, is that she has this cane. She's climbing this mountain, and in some ways, we are all climbing mountains too. We all have difficulties, things that maybe aren't so easy, aren't so straightforward. Hopefully everything isn't a mountain in your life, but we do have these. In my mind, she's just taking one step after the other. She's sick and feeble. She gets to the top, or maybe she's not even at the top, but she's resting. She puts down her robe and her bowl. So she puts everything down. And then the mass of darkness is shattered. The darkness of ignorance, the darkness of not seeing clearly. Again, we have this kind of this shift in the visual field before Padacharya went from light to dark. And now we have maybe going from dark to light, being able to see something she hadn't seen before. We might ask ourselves, what would it be like for us to put things down? Just like Chitta is putting the robe, the alms bowl, maybe the cane, everything she's carrying, she's resting, she puts it down. She lets go. And there's awakening. Is there a way in which we can put things down, or at least loosen the clinging? So maybe we're, instead of holding on so tightly, we hold or maybe support with open palms. That allows us maybe to see things more clearly, experience things more clearly. And then Matty Weingast, another poet, who is inspired by this poem, writes another poem based on this one. That poem goes like this. Somehow I kept climbing, though tired, hungry, and weak, old too. At the top of the mountain, I spread my outer robe on a rock to dry, set down my staff and bowl, took a deep breath and looked around. It was windy up there. As I was leaning back against a large gray rock, the darkness that I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept itself away on the wind. As I was leaning back against a large gray rock, the darkness that I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept itself away on the wind. Something I appreciate about Matty Weingast's version is this idea of these darknesses that we carry with us sometimes. And just the idea that it slipped and swept itself away. So maybe less of the practitioner here making it go away. And just with the wind, just with nature, off it goes. So maybe having put down or let go or no longer clinging, just allowed things to go where nature takes them without us having this feeling like we have to make them or make them go away. But again, this kind of interesting thing about this person's climbing the mountain, she's putting effort in, she's practicing one foot after another. And then it's with this in-betweening, this leaning back against a rock, then something else can happen. So this recognition of there's these rhythms of practice, times in which we're really maybe the more effort, the more intentional, and then some ease. But you can't take the ease if there hasn't been a certain amount of effort, a certain amount of intentionality, which doesn't mean, right, that we have to be huffing and puffing and straining up a mountain. This is just an analogy, but there is a pointing to a certain commitment, a certain intention to spend one's time, one's energy doing this work. I'd like to read another poem. In this poem, this nun talks about how she, what the expression is, went forth. To go forth is to ordain, is to become a monastic, to dedicate one's life, you know, full time to the monastic life, which includes going for alms rounds and living in community, especially if you're a nun. The nuns have less time alone than the monks for safety reasons. And this is a real commitment to practice. And I appreciate that sometimes we might have this idea of like, okay, well, the monastics, you know, they, because they've dedicated their life to practice, that it's maybe a little bit easier for them. Or, you know, they don't have mortgages and kids and partners and news, you know, all these things that we have, the traffic, you know, this kind of whatever it might be. So here's this poem by Sama. In the 25 years since I went forth, I don't know that I ever found serenity in my mind. I'd failed to find peace of heart or any control over my mind. When I remembered the victor's instructions, I was struck with a sense of urgency. Though subject to so many painful things, I have, through my love of diligence, reached the ending of craving and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. This is the seventh day since my craving dried up. 25 years, she talks about, right? This is a long time. But something about, she writes, when I remembered the victor's instructions, when she remembered the Buddha's instructions, struck with a sense of urgency. Sometimes we hear things over and over again, but it's not until a certain conditions are in place in which we feel like they resonate, or maybe that we understand them in a way that we hadn't understood them before. I know this has happened to me so many times, where rereading a sutta, I love to read the sutta, so often I'm like rereading them and thinking that I know everything that's in there. I'm like, oh, now I understand what's here. Hearing a Dharma talk, like sometimes one that it was recorded and having heard it the first time took something away from it, but then again later realizing something else was there. Maybe you all have this experience as well. So just one time in particular, she is bringing to mind the teachings. This idea, this sense of urgency is this sense of really wanting to practice. The Pali word is samvega, Maybe some of you have heard of this inspiration to practice, but with a sense of urgency, a sense of commitment, or a sense of I really want to do this. This is what's important for me in my life right now. So also this practitioner wasn't able to find ease in the beginning, but she stuck with it. She didn't disrobe. She practiced earnestly. She wrote, the poem says, with my love of diligence. So just coming back in whatever way made sense for her at that time. And she talks about, excuse me, thank goodness for mute buttons. She talked about reaching the ending of craving. Oops, sorry. So maybe there's... I think I'm making a mess of this. There we go. I think maybe my mask was over my microphone. Okay, there we go. So for her, the freedom was described or expressed or as the ending of craving, shattering the mess of darkness or ending of craving. There's so many different ways this can get expressed. It's maybe not exactly the same for everybody, or maybe it is, I don't know. But the way it gets expressed or the way it shows up or... it's different for different people. And I'd like to share also another poem that Maddie Weingast wrote based on the poem that I just read, having heard that poem, feeling inspired, wrote another poem. And it goes like this. After 25 years on the path, I'd experienced almost everything except peace. When I was young, my mother told me that I would find true happiness only in marriage. Remembering her words all those years later, something in me began to tremble. I gave myself to the trembling, and it showed me all the pain this little heart had ever known, how countless lives of searching had brought me at last to the present moment, which I happily married. Can you imagine? We've been living together ever since without a single argument. So this idea of marrying the present moment, you know, this kind of like commitment to, well, I'm just going to be here. I appreciate this very much, this person. She has this, had this socialized a certain way, these expectations, how she should live her life. And kind of, you know, twisted it a little bit, modified a little bit, and made it her own way, found her own way. Marrying the present moment, and that's where she found the happiness. So maybe all these 25 years when she hadn't found peace, she was always thinking that the next moment would bring the happiness, you know, something that's over there or in another time or something like this. But instead, kind of when finally finding this commitment to be here. And I also appreciate in here is this, these lines, something in me began to tremble. I gave myself to the trembling. So just allowing to be what her experience was. Trembling is uncomfortable, I'm imagining, but stayed with it. And that maybe gave her the confidence to say, oh yeah, I can do this. I can be with the present moment. Even if it shows up in this way, that's with some trembling. So, in these poems I've read, there's a few themes. One we might say is some diligence and practice, which doesn't have to mean straining or doesn't have to mean overexertion. It just means like this sense of this is what I'm going to do now. I'm going to practice now. And this is part of the art of practice, is to know like how much effort. Right? This one person became awakened when she leans back against a rock. Right? So there's a certain amount of ease that's required. But also she was climbing up a mountain, so a certain amount of one step after the other. There's also difficulties on the path. Some of us might have come to this practice because we had difficulties in our life and we were discovering that there was some ease or some maybe some wisdom that we could relate to that was happening, that we could find in this path of practice. But it's not uncommon for, I would say, this practice, but I would say any spiritual practice. There's going to be some difficulties, right? If we want to be transformation or some shifting in our inner life, it's going to be uncomfortable sometimes. How could it not be uncomfortable? So just a recognition, and that maybe things don't happen on the timeline or the way that we expect or hope or had thought it would be. Also, this another theme is idea that awakening shows up in many different ways, whether we're talking about complete liberation or just some awakening, some liberation from whatever is binding us up at that time. Some of the more mundane ways in which we find greater ease, some greater peace, shows up in all kinds of different ways and so many different ways to express it. Different people express it differently, and maybe at different times they express it differently. But one thing also that these poems have that's maybe a more of a mood or a tone, is there a sense of confidence? And maybe a sense of delight also we hear in this. That once they have found greater freedom, then there's this sense of, I don't know, I get this sense of a certain uprightness, and this is what happened, you know, like that they're just sharing their story, describing what happened, without being shy, without bragging, just a certain sense of confidence and delight and clarity, using language that makes sense to them. So I'd like to end with this one, the last poem. It's written by Maddie Weingast. But, I don't know, I feel touched by it. There's something, for me, it's very evocative. It uses a simile. I might say that, I don't know, I feel touched by. We'll see how you relate to this, but. While walking along the river, after a long day meditating on Vulture Peak, I watched an elephant splashing its way out of the water and up the bank. "Hello, my friend," a person waiting there said, scratching the elephant behind its ear. "Did you have a good bath?" The elephant stretched out its leg. The person climbed up, and the two rode off like that, together. Seeing what had once been so wild, now a friend and companion to this good person, I took a seat under the nearest tree and reached out a gentle hand to my own mind. Truly, I thought, this is why I came to the woods. Seeing what had once been so wild, now a friend and companion to this good person. I took a seat under the nearest tree and reached out a gentle hand to my own mind. This idea of our practice, sometimes our mind feels like a wild, wild creature, and elephants, right, can be very destructive and very powerful. But to befriend them, instead of this idea that they have to be doing something different or they should do that or shouldn't do that, but just to befriend them. So may we all contribute our own poems in whatever way that makes sense to us, whether they're actually written poems or maybe there's just the way that we live our life. But may we all contribute our poems to the human race. And may this verse, this poem, be for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Thank you.